or colleges, we would call them here, the military academies, the training of the fighters, the theory that they fight under, the preparations, and those academies in Qassam grew really significantly under Hakim Issa. He came from abroad, brought his expertise from Lebanon, Iran, and Syria into the Gaza Strip, and worked with a number of the military academies. And ultimately, his final position was in the Combat Weapons Directorate. So key leadership figures. He was assassinated back in June. And then the next one we have here is Abu Obeidah. The spokesperson said, today we reveal his real name, Hudayfa Samir Abdullah Al-Khalut. He was killed in August in an assassination in Al-Ramal that targeted his house. He was found out that his kunya is not Abu Obeidah, but it's Abu Ibrahim. And the new Abu Obeidah said that Hudayfa Al-Khalut was an icon of the free people of the world, the pulse of Palestine, never cut off from his people, even in the darkest of circumstances. His addresses from the heart of the battle for two decades set the tone for the resistance in Gaza. Our enemy's audience often waited for him before his own people to hear his decisive word. We know that is true from the Israelis. Abu Obeidah was assassinated while visiting his family, which is an important note because this detail indicates that he had somehow outed his place visiting his family, but not outed the military media apparatus. Because if Israel had access to the military media apparatus, we would have seen the unraveling of that apparatus over the final months that we did not see. And we didn't see the assassination in a bunker or in a tunnel. It was in his house. And so 2 years of war with the United States and Israel's assets flying over constantly, their surveillance, their most expensive surveillance in the world, and they have no idea how the military media apparatus functions. And I think that that's a real interesting detail. 11 civilians were killed, including a number of his children were killed in that assassination. He's not a spokesperson, and that is something that's really important to say. He was the head of the military media apparatus, and that is far more than a spokesperson. The Israelis were really interesting here, and just a couple things that I wanted to point out about the way the Israelis, after assassinating Abu Obeidah, they released a whole bunch of material that they said showed his role in the media apparatus. And some of it is interesting to hear from their perspective. Army Radio said that in the background of Trump's statement, this is from some months ago, this would be early September, according to Trump, Israel is losing the public relations war in Gaza, quote unquote. And that is because of Abu Obeidah, according to Israeli Army Radio. They said Qassam's military media apparatus included about 1,500 fighters, in comparison, about twice as many as the regular IDF soldiers has in equivalent units, the IDF spokesman and influence department. So they're right out here getting ahead of this, being like, oh, the reason why Qassam's media was 10 times better than us is because they had more people in the command of it. It's very interesting. And they have a number of things that they said in here that are just plain wrong, that Hamas publishes videos, that they stream the videos from the helmet cams, from the head cams, from the GoPros. They stream it to a central location, which is not true. And if they did do that, they probably wouldn't have lasted the war if they operated on that manner. But just the confidence with which Army Radio says that, that the units of fighters transmitted back to a war room where they would receive the materials in real time. So it didn't matter if the squad was eliminated, the video material exists. That's not true. The video material existed. If the fighters were killed, that video was lost. And that shows you the number of fighters that were still in the battle. And Israel wants to cover that up by saying that everything, no matter, we killed all these fighters, don't worry about it, because they project their footage back to a main base. Army Radio said that Abu Obeidah was personally involved in every Hamas combat procedure. No military move by Hamas in recent years, Protective Edge, the Great March of Return, Guardian of the Walls, and of course, off October 7th, would have been carried out without the approval of being accompanied by a standard combat procedure and the approval of Abu Obeidah. So they're really setting him up as the key figure in the military media apparatus, which is interesting to note, because if that is true, that they have 1,500 members of this apparatus, that gives you an indication of both the size of the organization, but also the quality figures that can come and replace that because they have that architecture already in place. So interesting to note from the IDF, because of course, even if it is true that Qassam has twice the number of media reporters embedded with their units than the IDF footage, you couldn't get the same footage as Qassam because the IDF doesn't fight the same way. They don't fight tactically with the acumen of the Qassam fighters. They don't have the courage of the Qassam fighters. And that's why we saw from the Israeli media apparatus, Israeli soldiers shooting at walls and whatnot. The way that Abu Ubaidah came about to be the spokesperson was actually unexpected. He was fighting in the battle at the time in northern Gaza, the Battle of Jabalia in 2004. I covered that previously on the show, a two-week battle in Jabalia camp, Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, that went on for 2 weeks. It was a total siege. A lot of things that looked like Gaza today, but just on a smaller, more confined area. And Abu Ubaidah was in that battle, fought in that battle, and was going to be the person to deliver anonymously the message from that battle. The intention was that Qassam would have these fighters be anonymous and give their battlefield update. And Abu Ubaidah did such a good job that nobody else ever did that again. And from that moment in 2004 on, every time the resistance spoke, it was Abu Ubaidah who delivered that. The trajectory of the media office really does begin with the Second Intifada, the formalized. Of course, they released statements before in previous eras. Of course, we know back in the First Intifada in the 1980s, they would release field reports and communiques of all types. But as the digital age came about, the internet came about, the Second Intifada came about, all those things kind of came together, coalesced. With the growth of the information office of the media apparatus, military media apparatus, the difficulty in that era was that your camera was the size of like a small car. But as digital and the internet came in subsequent years, Qassam, of course, adapted and made it so that the GoPro camera, the car, the reverse camera was taken, used out of cars. They had thousands of GoPro cameras. And so as technology developed, so did the organization develop. They went from having a single cameraman in 2001 to four in 2002, and it grew from there, which straddles the development of video and digital video along with the internet. So they were right on the cutting edge of that process. The story of their media development is really a story of Abu Ubaidah. He was obviously an extraordinarily qualified figure to build that movement. And that movement that he built is not an individual. It's a massive apparatus within each unit, within each company, even at the squad level, all the way along through the organization. There's an embedded military media member within that organization. So a long history, and it will be resilient, the military media apparatus, despite losing Abu Ubaidah. And the new Abu Ubaidah signed off his speech yesterday the same way the original Abu Ubaidah signed off, by saying it's victory or martyrdom. So that is the resistance report for day 816 of the genocide in Gaza.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Last but not least on the show, we join the Electronic Intifada's beloved contributor, Abu Bakr Abid, who was evacuated earlier this year from Gaza to pursue his studies in Ireland.
Hi, Abu Bakr. How are you?
Well, I'm really good, thank you. And what a pleasure to be here again with all of you.
Well, Abu Bakr, it's great to see you. And you have been busy with your studies, which is very important. And we're very happy that you are focusing on your studies. That's fantastic. But you're also continuing to do your journalism work. You've done a couple of really powerful stories for the Electronic Intifada recently about the Committee to Protect Journalists. Why don't you just tell us very quickly what that story was about?
First and foremost, I think since day one, I've been following the CPJ, and honestly, I was really fed up with everything the CPJ has been doing, especially from Jody Jansberg. And it was clear because they were always kind of functioning as a hub for Israel's claims and saying after the killing of any journalists in Gaza, which has happened very frequently since day one, that Israel claims that they were operating for Hamas, or, you know, they were mouthpieces for Hamas or something like this. And then Judy would say, or would push for an investigation, basically, of such claims, which was obviously wrong. And it was clear that journalists in Gaza, either it was me when I was in Gaza or any other of the journalists now on the ground, that we didn't have time to do anything except totally focusing on reporting the news and reporting the events which were happening every single second of the day, right? And then Jody was very clear that, well, our priority, that's my belief, our priority, that their priority was never Palestine, that we are committed to protect journalists except for Palestine. So one day, this group of whistleblowers, they contacted me, and I was really surprised, and they told me that there are things that people are not aware of, and people are simply kind of deceived by Judy Jansberg and what she's saying. But here is the memo, and here's what she's doing, and here's what happened, and this man or this former staffer has been fired by the committee for showing strong positions on Palestine and what is happening in Gaza. And honestly, people shouldn't really be kind of shocked about it, because that's an organization that works in the United States. That's an organization that works under a lot of pressure. And it's clear, you know, pro-Israel donors, they've donated over $250,000. I don't know if she claims impartiality and objectivity. I don't think there is any sense of impartiality, objectivity left when we're talking about pro-Israel donors.
And what you show in the article is how they've been very careful with the language of being very careful not to call what's happening in Gaza genocide. And so it's a really good, really carefully researched article. So well done, Abu Bakr, for the great journalism. Abu Bakr, we've been talking, we had Ahmed Nauq on a little bit earlier. The situation in Gaza, what are you hearing from friends and family? What's their mood? What's their reality? What can you tell us?
I honestly always receive pleas from people who live in utterly disastrous conditions. I think one of the things that people are always dreaming of is to find the ceiling, which is one of the things that keeps striking me over themselves, because they're always soaked with water, especially these days. And I don't like talking about this, but honestly, I'm trying my best, my very best, because I'd like to be sincere in what ever I do and help people with it. And a lot of people, they are really looking for an apartment, the wreckage of one of the still precarious houses in Gaza that have been destroyed by the Israel, that have been damaged by the Israeli military, or they're trying to find kind of a really good tent, a well-fortified tent that would protect them from the cold. But at the same time, what I was shocked by was that the neighbors who are still there and whom I was meeting when I was in Gaza and sometimes interviewing, they still have the same clothes on their bodies. This hasn't changed. And I left Gaza 8 months ago, and I witnessed that winter a year ago, right, in Gaza. But they still have the same set of clothes on their bodies, and that can tell you everything about it. Now, in terms of food, I'm really glad that people are eating much more. They have access. Things are more affordable. But how things are more affordable, this is not for the entire population, because I know a lot of families that don't have access to work. They are unemployed. And, you know, the unemployment rates already in Gaza because of the genocide, it has unbelievably skyrocketed. And a lot of people, they depend on mutual aid organizations. They depend on humanitarian organizations. And again, and I want to reiterate this, I don't And a lot of people, the vast majority of people in this trip, they do not trust the international organizations for what they have done, for what they have been standing for since day one. And Dr. Ali, you talked about UNRWA, you talked about the World Food Program, right? And you're talking about these organizations. But we have to confront them with what they're doing. They are capable, Dr. Ali, believe me or not, they're capable of pressuring the Israelis to reopen the borders and let them in. But that's not their main interest. And that has been reported in the new humanitarian piece that was revealed a few months ago when the head of the OCHA in Gaza said, and didn't pressure the Israelis enough, according to the whistleblowers from the OCHA, the head said that she instead pressured to get stray dogs' food in. And that can tell you everything about it. And from what I've seen, just one final point on that, or from what I've seen in Gaza, I can tell you, their priority for the vast majority of them is not the people of Gaza. Their priority is fame and money. That's what it can tell you. That's why people are still suffering. They can pressure the Israeli military more. They can pressure the Kogad. They can do more. But they are just giving people mere platitudes. That's why the suffering continues intense and not available for loads and loads of families who are still stranded in Gaza, and they are really soaked with water. And it's sad and it's tragic that we are having more children, people dying from hypothermia. I mean, we're living in 2026 and we are in the most sophisticated era of the entire world since its establishment, but we're still having people dying from cold, which is absolutely devastating.
I think, Abu Bakr, you were talking about this article from the New Humanitarian, which is very critical of how some UN officials were downplaying, particularly at the time the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was still in existence, and they were saying, well, maybe we should stop criticizing it so much and try and get along with it. So there were some leaked memos there. You're talking about that. The reality now, though, is that those UN agencies are the only ones that are getting anything in substantial quantities, even though it's far short of what is needed. And people should always do their due diligence, ask organizations what they're doing, look for current updates about their work in Gaza and so on, so that if they want to support organizations, they can find the ones who are being effective, with the understanding that all of this is a fraction of what's needed. And
it's also important to tell him, sorry to cut you off on this point, but it's also important to note, and from speaking to people who have worked within these organizations since day one, either foreigners or from the people of Gaza, it is important to mention to the people who are hearing me at the moment, and with the examples and the evidence that I do have and the witnesses, that the people of Gaza who are appointed within these organizations, including UNRWA, the WFP and others, are taking far, far, far less salaries than the foreigners who are coming from outside just for a week to do a mission inside Gaza. And one example is one woman I was talking to. She was offered $500 from a UK-based humanitarian organization per week for 6 days work. And every day is more than 8 hours work. That is unimaginable. Meanwhile, the operators of the organizations who work from outside, they take more than over $5,000 around this. That is important to mention. That is the corruption that
And that's also sort of structural within the so-called humanitarian aid system worldwide. That's not just Gaza, but certainly is even more exacerbated in Gaza right now. Abu Bakr, we have a question for you and a video we want to show. Let's show this video and then you can talk about the yellow rose.
We see hope. This is our yellow rose. It is, in fact, the best thing we have at the moment, because we see hope through it. Despite the structure, despite the truly unbearable circumstances we are living under at the moment, we still seek out hope. We still see hope. We are sending here the message it made, the message of the way from Gaza, especially in my area, that we want you to be with us. We want you to have our back.
always and every time, because we see you helping you. We are sending, and I, Abu Bakr, is sending a message of love, a message of hope to every one of you from Sinti Gaza and Gary.
So you grew that yellow rose in Gaza. We could hear the drones buzzing in the background in that video. That was, remind me, that was early 2024?
I think it's late 2024.
Late 2024. When you watch that, what feelings and memories does it bring up for you?
It's a roller coaster of emotions, I think. And openly speaking now, since you mentioned home, I think I've lost a lot since leaving Gaza. I've really, really lost a lot. And I'm someone so much connected with my family, especially my parents. And I'm yearning to get back and see them, to be honest, and be with them. I have so much love for them and everyone around me. It's really heartbreaking, but I know I need to stick stronger and do whatever I can from here, and hopefully can see them back. But it also gives me the fact, or gives me the sense, that I also need to continue. I mean, as I saw hope in Gaza amid all that devastation, despair, and death, I can also see hope here. And I need to continue no matter what. So I really miss everything back home. I mean, the beauty of this very, very stunning yellow rose, the beauty of the other plants, green plants in the courtyard of my house back home, the people in Deir el-Balah, I mean, Deir el-Balah especially, the stunning, the very fascinating, stupendous palm trees. I mean, the sunrise, what a terrible country Ireland is in terms of sunrises.
We have a lot of people from Ireland watching.
I'm really sorry, but it's, I don't know what to say, but.
Doesn't compare to a Mediterranean sunrise.
I think everything in Gaza, when you taste it and when you touch it, it gives you a different sense. Believe me, there's a sense of love planted in everything that you really touch or see or witness or whatever you do with it in Gaza. Here, I don't see it, to be honest, at all. So whether the yellow rose or anything, I mean, a very, very, very tragic sense of nostalgia, but we still have to go on no matter what.
But we didn't know that that was what was going to happen, but that yellow rose that you grew and you showed and you shared really did inspire a lot of people, and it became a symbol.
What an honor. It's been 2 years since knowing you, and I can say, and I will say this, what an honor to be part of your team. There's no such honor that I've had in my life, to be honest. Everything about it, I mean, sometimes people get short of words, but I've always been short of words when it comes to describing my sensations being with you and talking to you and writing for you. No words, to be honest.
It's really our honor, Abu Bakr. Yeah. You've made a huge impact despite all that you have lived through and your family has lived through and the losses of dear loved ones in your family and your friends. I know that you've lost very dear close friends in this genocide, as has pretty much everyone in Gaza. You've continued to advocate, to speak out, to do really brilliant journalism, and to study and advance your education, which is, I'm saying in public, very, very important to keep doing. So what should people be doing to keep, you know, people are concerned about Gaza, they're concerned about Palestine, they want to keep it front and center. What are some of the things you're seeing people doing that you think are effective, or that you think we should be doing collectively to keep raising the banner?
I really commend the actions of the Palestine Action prisoners. I really commend their actions. And I think, yeah, they're really great. I think people, the only thing that I've always been hoping to see people doing, and a lot have been doing, is to ensure that Israel is isolated. That's what I say. I mean, as a Carlson.
So the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, for example.
I mean, I think people have to understand that we don't, as Carlsons, and Palestinians in Gaza in particular, We don't governments to send us millions of euros in aid and all of it gets stuck on the border. We need governments to ensure, to be pressured, to ensure that they have nothing to do with Israel, to isolate Israel. For example, here in Ireland, you have a scenario that this government has been pressured and called on since day one by the people to stop trading with Israel, to not occupy Turkey's bill, and to stop American fighter jets to go through its airspace, but nothing has been effective since day one. And this is more destructive. And as I always say, don't help me endure the pain. Help me end the occupation and free my homeland. That's what we need to understand. I don't want the American government to send me aid. I want the American government to stop aiding Israel. The same for every Western country, the same for every European country. And I like, again, mass civil disobedience is really, really important. And we hope that this will continue. I think people should stick to that and to ensure that until the final day when Palestine is free, that's the moment that not just Palestinians will get benefit from, but also the entire people. I mean, things in the UK are really insane. I mean, the British government is on a leash by the lobby groups, the Jewish lobby groups, and the same everywhere. I've never seen it like this before. So this crackdown has to be stopped. And I really hope that people dismantle the Zionist lobby groups everywhere. I hope so. I really, really hope so.
You are doing a lot of things and carrying a lot of weight, and we're very proud of you for doing that. Thank you so much, Abu Bakr, for joining us today.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
That was journalist Abu Bakr Abed. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Hi, my name is Taku. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons and campers. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Celebrating Vancouver's underground rock music culture for 3 days of shows from incredible local and touring artists, the second annual Unreal City Festival takes over the Rickshaw Theatre and the Russian Hall, January 15th to 17th, featuring local artists like Worry War, Jody Glenham, so let it keep raining. CJSF chart toppers Devour, and the Houseplant. Veterans by a thread. And headliner Spencer Krug of Wolf Parade, Sunset Rubdown, and Moonface. This unique festival finds bands and music artists upstairs, while downstairs you get access to the coziest grandma's living room style lounge in the city, with DJs, hot food, drinks, on-site tattoo artists, and more. The second annual Unreal City Festival, January 15th to 17th at the Rickshaw Theatre and the Russian Hall in East Vancouver. For passes, go to unrealcity.rocks or head to CJSF Music on Instagram to win tickets.